I am Gaius. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. Germanicus is here, and we're reflecting upon the Eurasia bloc formed with a visit of Vladimir Putin to Xi Jinping, which is reminding exactly of the visit in February of 72 of Richard Nixon to Beijing to visit with Mao. As Xi follows Mao, Putin follows Stalin, establishing a Soviet empire with buffer states. As Mao saw his role, as Stalin saw his role, but it was not successful because the two did not work together. There was never a moment similar to the one we just witnessed in Beijing. Now we go to the tactical level. Within these last days, there have been several headlines in many publications, including the Wall Street Journal, suggesting that NATO may need to send trainers to Ukraine. There's been some collapse of some frontline positions, and there's a general exhaustion of the Ukrainian army. There's a shortage of manpower. There are weapon systems coming in, but there's still rules of engagement that restrict Ukraine from making total war on the much larger and much deeper Russian military. However, trainers. What is a trainer? Well, a trainer is similar to what we called advisors in the Vietnam War. You know how that worked out. So I come to you, Germanicus. Trainers in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has said again and again since the beginning of this conflict, this is a war with NATO, not with Ukraine. NATO is attacking Russia. We, Russia, are fighting to exist. We regard NATO as making the same poor decision that Napoleon did in 1812, that the Hitlerites did in 1941. And therefore, we will resist entirely to the end. And that includes our strategic forces are always on alert. There was one sentence in the 7,000-word statement issued out of Beijing by Xi and Putin talking about strategic forces should never be used. So, is NATO tempting Moscow? Does NATO intend to cross the red line? Does Moscow accept the bluff?
When I said or brooded a few minutes ago that NATO had embarked upon a doom strategy, I was referring to the hidden but extremely dangerous and risky dynamics of proxy war. Even as people like Lawrence Friedman in the UK have protested that this is not a proxy war. The fact is, this was not only a proxy war, of which there have been many, and they are ordinary proxy wars where you jab your main enemy with a needle, get under his skin, try to gain an advantage somewhere along the margins or the rimlands of his world. It's a game. And of course, the British and the Russians in the Victorian era called it the Great Game. But what we have in Ukraine is not an ordinary proxy war. It is an existential proxy war. And I use that word advisedly in large part because it's the most overused word in regard to the Ukraine war that I've ever heard applied to it. And yet it's true. For Russia, this is an existential war. And an existential proxy war is a war where the proxy protagonist uses a third party, not simply to needle and get under the skin of the main enemy, but to bring that main enemy down. In other words, the situation between the third party and the main enemy promises potentially to lead to the toppling, the collapse potentially of the main enemy. And it is almost too much to resist. And in the case of the U.S. and NATO, it couldn't resist the opportunity and the conceit to believe that somehow the third party, in this case Ukraine, could bring down the main enemy, in this case Russia. Now, it's ironic to me that the U.S. has been involved in two existential proxy wars in its history. And in the first, the U.S. was the proxy, and Britain was the main enemy, and France and Spain were the proxy protagonists who sought to bring Britain and its empire down. And they basically succeeded.
They did a nice job. Come on, Germanicus. Hiring what? Washington was brilliant. Brilliant.
It was. And yet, when France and Spain did not intervene until the war was 3.5 years in, and the colonists, and Washington especially, had won 3.5 campaigns. In other words, they only went double down when it was a sure thing. Now, the second proxy war that the U.S. was involved in that was existential was the Civil War. And it was interesting because the U.S. was both the main enemy that Britain sought to bring down, and part of the former U.S., the Confederacy, was the third-party proxy. And the U.S. managed to escape being the victim of Great Britain simply because Britain wasn't ready to get into a world war with the United States and Russia. And you can check all that out. It's all there in the books. Now, this proxy war is different, and it's different in a really critical way. Because in the Civil War, Britain backed out when it became clear in the winter of 1863-4 that the South wasn't going to make it.
I know, but you remind me that Jubal Early's raid on D.C. in July of 64, that was close, Germanicus, very close. I just did the scene where Stanton sent the clerks to the front lines, and Lincoln got out there standing on the parapet with bullets flying around, the only general who's ever been in a combat zone.
I have to remind you, however, that there were more Union troops in those 86 forts surrounding Washington than Jubal Early could muster. And those forts had 10,000 pieces of artillery. It was a heroic sort of last.
I just enjoyed you flashing that detail.
Well, the point here, and I think it's an important point to make, is that Britain got out not only because the South wasn't going to make it, but there was a populist rising in Britain. And this, remember, was the time of the Second Reform Act and an expanding electorate. And British working men did not like the Confederacy the way the British ruling class liked it. So there were two factors there, and they're somewhat reminiscent of what's going on today. Ukraine is losing, and there's a populist rising in the U.S. But what's happened is that the U.S. and NATO has made the completely opposite choice than Whitehall made in 1864.
Is NATO bluffing about trainers? Is Russia going to call our bluff?
Russia will try to call our bluff. What I'm worried about is that, and this is connected to the second example, the U.S. Civil War, is that NATO and the U.S., in all of their public announcements and pronouncements, has shown itself to be getting ready to double down. Giant military exercises in NATO, all sorts of officials, Polish, Lithuanian, Estonian, saying that we want to put troops in. The U.S. saying that it's inevitable that there will be trainers, NATO trainers, in Ukraine. It goes on and on, and it could all be grandstanding, but it is taking NATO and the U.S. step by step into a war with Russia. And this is exactly what Britain decided to back off from in 1864. And yet we're doing the opposite, and it's extremely dangerous. It's one thing for Britain and France, I mean, for France and Spain to double down when the victory of the colonies was practically assured. It's quite another when the proxy that you have suborned is desperate and in danger of collapse, because the only alternative you have then is a direct confrontation with the main enemy. And the whole reason you engage in the proxy war was so that wouldn't happen. So, yes, one would hope that NATO and the U.S. would back off at the last minute. But it's a funny reversal here. Starting an existential proxy war with Russia.
We have 1 minute, Germanicus. Go ahead.
Yeah. Engineering a proxy war with Russia to bring it down is one thing. But to have the situation turn around so that you are now in an existential situation, whether it's real existential or whether it's simply a belief, an imagined existential situation, is a very dangerous place to be. And at this point, NATO and the U.S. are on the hook. Their entire legitimacy and authority hinges on coming through now. If they don't come through, it's almost worse than just letting Ukraine be defeated. It's a defeat for NATO and the U.S. So we've managed to take an existential proxy war for Russia and make it existential for ourselves. That is quite an achievement.
Germanicus and Gaius, by the Thames in late spring of 91 AD, observing that there are some risks emerging in the 21st century, and we're going to turn to a subject that is entertaining to us, which is, does anyone ever lose an existential war? And what happens when they lose? Where do they go? This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.